Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we explore two, yes, two, brave Democrats who courageously stood up to the leftist mob in Louisiana and Nevada, and by doing so, defended the brilliant Electoral College system and the cause of life. This might just be a precursor of the looming civil war in the Democrat Party. Buckle up. This is Charlie Kirk, host of the Charlie Kirk Show. Is your dad a Trump supporter? It's Father's Day, and whether you love him or you hate him, Donald Trump is our 45th president and is making history in our lifetime. Noble Gold has the perfect gift for you and your dad. This is pretty amazing. Get this. A minted exclusive collector's piece, the Trump Freedom Coin. One side depicts an image of Donald J. Trump, while the other side lists all of his major achievements. I actually think this is a better gift if your father doesn't love Donald Trump. At less than $40 for each silver coin, this makes the perfect gifts for dads and grads. This commemorative limited edition 1 ounce silver coin is the only presidential Trump coin made up of 99.9% silver, not silver plating, and IRA approved. As the price of silver rises, so will the value of these coins. So it's a great investment too. These silver coins priced at less than $40 are a perfect gift for anyone. Act now. Go to TrumpCoin2020.com. Use code Kirk. Do it right now to get $5 off now. That's TrumpCoin2020.com. It's a perfect gift for your dad, the presidential Trump coin. Go to TrumpCoin2020.com and use promo code Kirk. Get $5 off. That's TrumpCoin2020.com. And use the code Kirk now. You won't regret it. This stuff, they're really, really cool. They're really fun. I got a couple myself, Noble Gold. But go to TrumpCoin2020.com and use the code Kirk now. All right, let's dive right into it. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Charlie Kirk Show on our usual day, Wednesday. Thank you for listening to our mini-show just a couple days ago where we talked about big tech and how conservatives should approach them as monopolies. Essentially, what is the free market approach to monopolies? We got such great response. And actually, since the dropping of that episode, you might have seen it on Twitter, you might have seen it online, Amazon is under unbelievable scrutiny right now for that massive cloud contract that we talked about in our episode. There, even Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and myself actually all agree. According to this report, Amazon was using very egregious unethical practices of offering a job to someone at the Department of Defense at Amazon if they were to get this through, which is, boy, let's open an investigation, because that, if you want to talk about crony capitalism, not free enterprise, not entrepreneurialism, but instead cronyism, isn't that it in its form, one of the world's most valuable companies? Going after a government official just to try to get this massive government contract for themselves. So check out that article, and it really is proof positive of everything we talked about a couple days ago in our big tech episode. Essentially, the subtext of that whole episode is, how should people who believe in the free market approach monopolies? We got great response on it. So I want to talk about two brave Democrats. Boy, that's an unusual thing you don't hear very often. Brave Democrats? I mean, the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the party of Rashida Tlaib, or the party of Ilhan Omar, the party of Cory Booker, the party of Hillary Clinton. Is there bravery left in the Democrat Party? Is there courage left in the Democrat Party? And I think what is missing so often from our country is a lack of courage. It's a lack of standing for what you believe in and standing against the mob. And if we're honest with ourselves, the Democrat Party has become a mob. The Democrat Party has become a mob on basically every major issue, but especially on the issue of guns and abortion. And so when you see a person say, especially within the Democrat ranks, raise their hand and say, you know what? I'm not going to go with the mob on this issue. I'm going to go against the grain. I'm going to be a contrarian. I'm going to stand for truth. I'm going to do something difficult and take the political repercussions as they come. And we saw two instances of this in the last week, and both are amazingly instructive, and I think they illustrate a trend you're going to start to see in the Democrat Party and the coming civil war in the Democrat Party. Two brave Democrats, the first of which, Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards. Louisiana's Democrat, that's right, Democrat governor signed a ban on abortion as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy last Thursday. I mean, my goodness, that puts him right in line with other conservative Southern leaders, such as Mississippi, Kentucky, Ohio, and Georgia. Alabama went even further, completely outlawing virtually all abortions. And so he has been getting unbelievable backlash from his own party. Planned Parenthood, the NARAL, which essentially is the most radical pro-choice organization out there, have gone after him in ways that you can't imagine. Now, John Bel Edwards actually has a personal connection to this issue. So John Bel Edwards, whose daughter had a spinal complication while she was in the womb of her mother, he decided not to have an abortion despite his doctors advising him to do so. So he signs a heartbeat bill, which could be anywhere between 6 weeks to 8 weeks. And shouldn't we be at a point in our country where abortion should not be legal when a baby has a heartbeat? Shouldn't that be a consensus that yes, that is a human life? Yes, that is something that is individual that should be protected. Obviously, a more dependent human life, obviously a different form of a human life, but a human life that should be preserved and protected. The Louisiana legislature overwhelmingly supported this ban with a 79-23 House vote and a 31-5 Senate vote. Think about that. Only five senators in Louisiana, state senators, opposed this abortion measure. So good on you, John Bel Edwards, Democrat governor from Louisiana. And I think this signals something that's really important. I think this, and the next example I'm going to use as we talk about two brave Democrats in the mob of the Democrat Party, in this sea of radicalism, you have two brave governors that have come out. We'll get to the second one in a second. I think this signals that they are trying to push back against the growing, intense, fervent radicalism within their own party, whether it be post-birth abortion endorsed by Governor Ralph Northam, or the New York abortion measure, or the Illinois abortion measure that was just passed and hopefully is not going to get signed into law by Governor Pritzker. I believe you are seeing these Democrats take a stand for what is right because they're worried that if this trend continues, there will be no more Democrats in the middle part of the country. There will be no more Democrats in states like Louisiana or states like Iowa. And we need more Democrats like this that will do what is right, that will do what is correct. And I will say, it is harder for a Democrat to stand up to their own party than a Republican is to stand up to their own party. When a Republican stands up to their own party, they get nice articles written about them in the Washington Post. Look at Mitt Romney. When Mitt Romney stands up to Donald Trump, he gets treated like a hero. When a Democrat stands up to their own party and does something that conservatives agree with, they get vilified. They get thrown under the bus. Mind you, when I was reading a lot of these articles about the abortion ban in Louisiana, and a lot of these articles written by Huffington Post and written by BuzzFeed that were trying to demonize and were trying to throw this entire issue in the wrong direction, they weren't even saying he was a Democrat. I mean, the media almost was saying radical governor John Bel Edwards. Well, you had to go all the way down to the bottom of some of these articles to actually see that it was a Democrat governor that was doing this. Another great example is Justin Amash. When Justin Amash opposes his own party, he gets nonstop wall-to-wall coverage on CNN and MSNBC. He gets beautiful write-ups in the New York Times, the sole Republican that stands for integrity and stands for the rule of law. But when a Democrat stands up to his own party or her own party, the backlash is immense. So I can make an argument, it's actually harder to be a brave Democrat than be a brave Republican, quote-unquote brave Republican, standing up against the Republican Party. I actually think a brave Republican is someone like Rand Paul or someone like Mike Lee that stands up to both parties. That's actually my definition of a brave Republican. But the mob is alive and well within the Democrat Party. And you could see the vitriol and the hatred hurled at John Bel Edwards. And good on him for doing the difficult but correct thing to stand up for life and to stand up for the unborn in Louisiana. So the second Democrat that was brave last week, and isn't it amazing that we are able to say that two Democrats did the right thing? You know, and I just want to reinforce this point. Democrats tend to be more collective, whereas Republicans are more individualistic. And so by definition and by actually how Democrats view politics and they view people, Democrats are much more likely to vote as blocks. Democrats are much more likely to look at things in the view of the collective, whereas we as Republicans, or if you're listening to this as a Republican, or those of us as conservatives, I should say, or conservatarian, if you listen to my second episode ever, Why I Believe What I Believe. If you haven't, I highly recommend it. Those of us that believe in the individual, we don't actually view each other as doing things in the collective always. It's the individual first, and then if we find people that agree with us, then we'll do things together. The Democrats are the opposite. It's we must be as one, almost like the Borg from Star Trek. We must be one entity together. So the second Democrat that did something bold and did something courageous, the Nevada governor, Nevada Democrat governor, Steve Sisolak. I believe I'm saying that correct. Governor Steve Sisolak. On Thursday, this is so important. I want to dive really, really deep into this because there's about 10 points I want to make on this particular issue, and then I want to kind of do a little history behind it because I believe this issue is not going anywhere. It's one of my most passionate issues and one of the most underappreciated and misunderstood issues in America today. Governor Steve Sisolak, last Thursday. Isn't it amazing that both of this happened on Thursday, by the way? I just think that's kind of cool that both these Democrats did something courageous on a Thursday. Vetoed a bill that would have seen his state join a growing movement to effectively end the Electoral College. This is done by an organization called the National Popular Vote. And so the Electoral College allows states to allocate their electors as they see fit. And we'll dive into a couple examples of that and why the Electoral College is so brilliant. And we're going to build out the actual philosophical and historical background and depth behind the Electoral College. But the Electoral College allows each state to allocate their votes as they see fit. So the national popular vote, they said, well, we're not going to be able to get a national popular vote passed through Congress. That's highly unlikely. So what if we do it through the states? What if we take a state such as California and we get a piece of legislation passed through California that says California will allocate their electoral votes based on whoever wins the national popular vote? So it will no longer be based on who actually wins the state. It'll be based on who wins the national vote, will then allocate the votes of the state. So this is essentially, it's reverse engineering the Electoral College. Some scholars think this is unconstitutional. Most don't. And actually, based on my own analysis, I don't think this is unconstitutional. A state can do whatever they want with their electoral votes. A state can say, you know, Ohio can say, we want to allocate our electoral votes based on the winner of the World Series. If an American League team wins it, then we'll give it to the Democrats. And if a National League team wins it, we'll give it to the Republicans. It could be that silly. I mean, the Constitution says the state is allowed to allocate their electoral votes as they see fit. But the one caveat of the national popular vote movement is that it's a national popular vote compact. It's called the Interstate Compact. So none of this is effective until 270 electoral votes do it. So right now they're up to 189 electoral votes. So for example, California has done it, Illinois has done it, and many other states across the country. Connecticut has done it, Washington has done it, states that are about to do it. If you're listening to the state and the state of Oregon, they're about to do it, push back against it. We're going to tell you why. And there's other states where it's passing through the legislation. Maine actually just failed in the Maine House, which is amazing on a bipartisan basis. They're trying to do it in Maine. In Minnesota, they've introduced it. They've introduced it in North Carolina. They've introduced it in Arizona. You get the point. They've done it all across the country. They've also passed it in more states than I think people realize. This has been happening so quickly and so rapidly. It's so well-funded. And it isn't amazing. I just want to talk about this. Isn't it amazing how little the media has focused on this? If the media wanted to draw attention to this, they would have. There would have been front page New York Times articles. There would have been wall-to-wall CNN, MSNBC coverage. The reason there hasn't been is that they don't want the attention on it. Because if the attention was drawn on this, states would begin to reject it. States would begin to rise up and Democrats and Republicans would be like, why do we want to give up our sovereignty? Why do we want to give up our state's voice to people in Manhattan, New York, or Malibu, California? Why do we want to do that? So they've done this really quickly. And so the state that really surprised me is Colorado. I saw Colorado pass this and I said, do Coloradans really realize what just happened here? They effectively, if this goes through to its fullest extent, Denver, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Grand Junction, the beauty of Colorado, the specific issues that matter in Colorado, a very purple state, but a state that is generally center-left, center-right. It kind of goes back and forth. It has a Republican senator and a Democrat senator who's running for president and a former Democrat governor who's running for president. But Colorado's a state that generally does things at work. It's a moderate state. They want to give up their voice to more radical parts of the country. And now there's actually a referendum pushing back against it in Colorado, one that could be put on the ballot. And that's really amazing. But the reason that I think this happened is that there just wasn't that much media. There was not that much media coverage around it. It just happened so quickly. And so the national popular vote is focused on getting this done in the states as quickly as possible. And so one of the states they thought it would be pretty much easy in their vote count. So they're at 189 right now. They thought they could easily get Nevada. I mean, no problem. And so they thought they could easily get to 195. They thought they could easily get the 6 votes that are needed. And so they pass it to the House. They pass it to the Senate. In fact, if you read a National Popular Votes website, and I encourage everyone listening to this podcast to listen intently, because if they are successful in this effort, and if they are successful in getting this done, our elections will never be the same. And I'm going to do an entire historical analysis and philosophical dive into the Electoral College in just a minute. So hang tight, because I'm sure a lot of you listening here got a lot of arguments that, well, we need one person, one vote. Who could possibly be against that? We're going to break that down in just a minute. But this Democrat governor, Steve Sisolak, did something that could only be described as valor and as courage and really surprising. It threw the entire National Popular Vote organization for a loop, because they did not expect this. They said, oh, he's a Democrat, he'll sign it. Oh, you know, he'll sacrifice Nevada's sovereignty. He'll sacrifice Nevada's 6 votes. And out of nowhere, he vetoed it. This hero vetoed it. And this is not a Republican or Democrat issue. In fact, he put forth this beautiful statement. So I'm going to read, quote, verbatim, Governor Steve Sisolak on Twitter, May 30th. My statement on the recent bill, quote, over the past several weeks, my office has heard from thousands of Nevadans. Isn't that great? Isn't this what our government should be all about? Grassroots accountability? I continue. Across the state, urging me to weigh the state's role in our national elections. After thoughtful deliberation. Isn't that amazing? I just want to stop. Isn't it great to have a politician do thoughtful deliberation? Boy, I wish we had that more often. Let me resume. After thoughtful deliberation, I have decided to veto, hero, Assembly Bill 186. It's just so rare. I'm sorry. I have to stop myself. It's just so rare to find a Democrat do something heroic. It's actually so rare to find a politician do something heroic that doesn't go along with the national narrative and doesn't go along with what the far left wants. Let me resume. Once effective, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact could diminish the role of smaller states like Nevada in national electoral contests and force Nevada's electors to side with whoever wins the national popular vote rather than the candidate Nevadans choose. I'm applauding Governor Steve Sisolak, because that is exactly the point of the Electoral College. Nevada is a frequently courted place for presidential candidates in Reno and in Clark County right there in Las Vegas, because it's a battleground state. A previous Republican stronghold that has now become a Democrat state, it's still going to be competed heavily in 2020. And he realizes and he recognizes that if he were to sign this bill and it goes to 270 votes, Nevada would matter less. He continues, I recognize that many of my fellow Nevadans may disagree on this point, and I appreciate the legislator's thoughtful consideration of this important issue. As Nevada's governor, I'm obligated to make such decisions according to my own conscience. In cases like this, where Nevada's interests could diverge from the interests of large states, I will always stand up for Nevada. Governor Steve Sisolak, you did a hard thing. You did the correct thing. Just like Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards, you did something that is contrarian to your own party, that is contrary to your own party. That's a better way to phrase it. And it's something that is correct. It's in the best interest of your state. It's in the best interest of your constituents. And it's the best interest of the sovereignty of what really matters of you as a governor. As a governor, you're supposed to look out for the best interest of people that put you there. And your vetoing this bill does exactly that. All right, everybody, we're going to get into the brilliance of the Electoral College, because I really want to do a deep dive on why the Electoral College was one of the most amazing pieces to our framework done by the Founding Fathers. The genius, the clairvoyance, the foresight. But first, here's why I'm a big fan of SimpliSafe Home Security. SimpliSafe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If a storm takes out your power, SimpliSafe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, SimpliSafe is ready. Say they destroy your keypad or siren, SimpliSafe will get you the help that you need. Here's what I love about this. Maybe it's overkill. Maybe you don't need to be ready for every worst case scenario, but SimpliSafe is always ready, just in case. That's what makes it great. Now, SimpliSafe could cost an arm and a leg. It should, but it doesn't. And that's why they're good people. And that's why you need SimpliSafe. It's only $14.99 a month. No contracts, no hidden fees. I use it. You have got to use it too. Go to simplysafe.com/Charlie. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. All right, let's dive right into it, guys. This is a monster segment. This issue is an issue that affects everyone listening to this podcast. Even if you're not listening to this podcast in the greatest country ever to exist, the United States of America, the future of America, and how America chooses its leaders affects every human being on earth, because as America goes, the rest of the world goes. And so I get this question almost more than any other question, especially recently, because there has been a deliberate and targeted campaign to destroy the Electoral College, specifically by the far left. And in the previous segment, we talked about the National Popular Vote Project, which is a well-funded effort that they say is bipartisan, but it's really radical leftists that are pushing it, and they're getting Republicans to agree to it. But let's just say it's a radical effort, because it is a radical effort, because anything that wants to deconstruct, anything that wants to tear apart how we elect and how we determine who is going to be the president of the United States is radical in nature. So let's take this one bit by bit, one piece at a time. First of all, what is the Electoral College? Now, for some of you, this will be a quick catch-up lesson. For some of you, this will be rather instructive, because there is so much misinformation around the Electoral College. The Electoral College is, of course, formed in the Constitutional Convention, which was the Great Compromise, because there was a discussion in 1787 when our founding fathers were meeting about how to form a government and how to actually put someone in the highest executive office, in the commander-in-chief position. There was disagreement. Should we go to a straight democracy? Should we go towards allowing the Senate to elect this person, or allow the House of Representatives to elect this person? And you can read in the Federalist Papers a couple years later, and sometimes simultaneous to that, the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, which were written as letters to newspapers in New York, the reflection of the Founding Fathers of exactly their thought process behind it. And so the great compromise that was essentially met is that as a country, we recognize that certain states will have more influence because they have a greater population, but we shouldn't ignore small states altogether. And so there was a recognition that there is a discrepancy between rural states and urban states. Both matter a lot, but they both should have some form of representation. And so dating back to actually how the Electoral College was formed, it was agreed upon that the total number of U.S. senators plus how many people they send to Congress will be how many electoral votes that each state gets. And now the exception to that would be the District of Columbia, which, of course, the District of Columbia sends 3 electoral votes in, which was due to a recent amendment that was passed. That's the exception. They don't send any members to Congress. They don't have any U.S. senators. That's the only exception, and that's a recent exception. So, for example, the minimum amount of electoral votes a state could have is 3. The maximum is obviously based on population. And so this has grown throughout the years, and this has, I think, been widely misrepresented by many, many people in the media and many people that have just made it their quest to oppose it at all costs. And so this is really important to remember. We are not a direct democracy, and we are not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. In fact, in the Constitution, Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, it reads, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a republican form of government." Now, I want to stop you. I'm sorry. Wait, Charlie, what? Our Constitution says republican? It does. Now, that's not to be confused with the Republican Party. It means in as a republic. Now, understanding the Founding Fathers, based on their knowledge of history, studying the British Empire, the Chinese Empire, the Babylonians, studying the Mesopotamians, studying all human history, they realize that unlimited power tends to become a tyrannical power really quickly. So they created the United States as a republic, not a pure democracy, with checks and balances. The Founding Fathers were not trying to create utopia. A couple episodes ago, I encourage everyone to listen, we really broke down Plato's Republic. We talked about how Plato wanted to create this philosopher king ruling class. The Founding Fathers didn't want that. They read Plato. They read Aristotle. And what's so amazing is if you read the Greeks and you read the French thinkers and you read the Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, all of them influenced the Founding Fathers. All of them influenced the greatest architecture of a government and a country we've ever seen. And you can actually see that they picked and they choosed from some of these thinkers and some of these writers, whether it be Aristotle, whether it be Plato, they didn't take too much from Plato, they took some of it, or whether it be David Hume and many other people. And so as the Electoral College went, it was perfected. And so let's just go through some of the big kind of questions against it. Is, you know, some people will say, well, Charlie, we should just have a national popular vote. That's essentially what the national popular vote talks about, is that whoever wins the popular vote, each state should vote towards. Well, let's extrapolate that a little bit. Let's pretend that we did have a national popular vote. Well, it's not that simple. Do we want to have a national popular vote based on who wins a majority of votes or who wins a plurality of votes? So two totally different things. So what's a majority? A majority is 50 plus one. That's a majority. A plurality would be whoever has the most, not the majority. So it could be 40%. It could be 30%. This is really important. It's a question that popular vote advocates actually disagree on. Some would say, well, we should have 50%, and then we should have 50%. If no one reaches that threshold, we can have a runoff. I think that's kind of silly, and I'll break that down. Last thing we need is more runoff elections in this country. But let's take the majority argument, for example. Well, Bill Clinton only won 43% of the popular vote. 43%, yet he was still elected president of the United States thanks to the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton, in 2016, despite winning the popular vote, she only won 48% of the popular vote. Let's pretend we did have a system based on plurality. You know what that would open the door to? Some of the most fractionalized political parties you could possibly imagine. You would have single-issue political parties rise to the top. Now, some people totally support this. I totally reject this. Because government should be a mixture of different issues that you can build broad-based coalitions behind to get something done. See, the problem is that the Founding Fathers and the framers of our country did not create the Congress to be a parliamentary system, similar to the United Kingdom and many other European countries. So if you were to elect a president based on a 10-party, 12-party, 20-party system like they do in Italy, our other branch of government is not designed to work like that. So if you have a single-issue president that ends up getting elected, well, first of all, they'll only cater to certain parts of the country. They might win 22% of the election, the electorate. And then what? Who's to hold them accountable? So what the Electoral College forces candidates to do is build broad-based coalitions. Coalitions based on issues of life, on guns, on markets, on faith, on foreign policy. Now people say, Charlie, I don't like the two-party system. Well, okay, that's fair enough, but can you show me a place where the multi-party system is really thriving? Do you think the United Kingdom is better or worse because of a multi-party system? I think it's way worse, to be perfectly honest with you. I think the dual-party system, and there are some exceptions to this because it's definitely not perfect because there's so many different types of Republicans, but large in part, you have a choice, you have distinctions, you have differences within this system. And so if you had a system by plurality, you would have 20 or 30 parties run on just specific single issues. You think our country is divided now? Just wait to see how divided that would be. So the last person running for president of the United States that actually won a electoral vote as a third party candidate was George Wallace in 1968. Now, Ross Perot famously ran in 1992. He got 19% of the national popular vote. Some would say he prevented H.W. Bush from becoming president. He actually did not win any electoral votes. And so the Electoral College forces candidates to go to states they otherwise wouldn't. The Electoral College is also historically defended against extremism in order to build broad-based coalitions. So George Wallace is the perfect example of this. George Wallace is the perfect example because George Wallace ran for president as a segregationalist in 1968. That's right. He ran as a pro segregation candidate, and he won states in the American South. Now, of course, what did that force? Well, it forced, in many different ways, the other candidates to build broad-based coalitions on public, widely held sentiment. It pushed, the Electoral College pushed the extremism to the fringes, which is exactly what we want, isn't it? We want the ideas that are quote-unquote mainstream to get the biggest platform possible. The Electoral College, time and time again, has historically defended against that kind of extremism because you need to have mainstream ideas in order to build broad-based coalitions. You need to have agreement, not disagreement, in order to win in an Electoral College. So if I were to break down the three big reasons for the Electoral College, it would be these three things. Number one is diversity. Number two is integrity. And number three is accountability. And we'll break all those three down right now. Number one is diversity. Diversity can be many different things. If you think, if you hear the word diversity, you might immediately think racial diversity. And guess what? This actually applies to the Electoral College too. But I mean just right now when I talk about diversity, I mean diversity of states. So let's break this down. Did you know every state except California, Texas, New York, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida have smaller populations than the city of Los Angeles? So that means 43 of 50 states have smaller populations than the entire city of Los Angeles. Now, mind you, it can be a little bit, that argument can be a little bit, I don't want to say deceiving, but I just want to add context to that argument to play devil's advocate against myself. The way Los Angeles draws its city lines is quite broad. Los Angeles County is the largest county in the country. I want to be fact-checked on that. It's either Los Angeles or New York, but it's one of the largest counties in the country. I believe it is the largest county. But that still means, let's just say LA proper. Is that fair to say, Mr. Producer? Great. LA proper has a larger population than 43 of 50 states. And so the issues that affect LA proper are not the issues that probably affect the 43 other states across the country. I think it's fair to say that the issues of Iowa and the issues of Tennessee, the issues of Kentucky, or the issues of North Dakota are not exactly the issues that affect LA County. Here are some quick facts for you really quick. If you just look at the counties won, the amount of counties won, and I love the idea of counties because counties are micro representation. Counties are the most accountable form of government. And we'll get to accountability in a little bit. Donald Trump won 2,626 counties in the 2016 election. Hillary won 487. And Hillary won the popular vote. She didn't win a majority of the popular vote. She won a plurality of the popular vote. States won. Trump won 30 states. Hillary won 20 states. Now, it's important to realize that there's only been four instances in American history where the winner of the electoral vote did not also win the popular vote. So it's actually an outlier. It does happen. It's happened twice in modern history, but it's only happened four times. The four examples would be in 1876, Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. I always love that name, don't you? Rutherford B. Hayes, with about 4 million popular votes, won 185 electoral votes, where his main opponent, Democrat Samuel J. Tiden, he won the popular vote with 4.3 million votes, but only won 184 electoral votes. Hayes was, of course, elected president. In 1888, Republican Benjamin Harrison, we talked about Republican Benjamin Harrison in a previous episode, he signed the Sherman Antitrust Act. In 1890, with 5.4 million popular votes, he won 233 electoral votes. His main opponent, Democrat Grover Cleveland, who, of course, went to be president anyway, he won the popular vote with 5.5 million, but only had 168 electoral votes. More recently, of course, George W. Bush lost the popular vote to Al Gore, but he won the electoral vote. And then most recently, 2016, Republican Donald Trump won the electoral vote, lost the popular vote. And so to go back and to say what I was saying, LA County is the largest county in America with 9.8 million people. Cook County, second biggest, with 5.2 million. Harris County near Houston, 4.1 million. I just wanted to make that, reinforce that point from earlier. So five times a candidate has won the popular vote and lost the election. And I want to actually go back. I said four times earlier. I'm adding one. It's also Andrew Jackson, 1824, to John Quincy Adams. So I'm adding that to the list. That's it. Five times in all the elections that we've had. Five times. And if I'm not mistaken, we've had 44 elections. We'll get that fact checked as well. And it's sometimes reported that Richard Nixon, this is a common urban myth, received more popular votes in 1960 than JFK. But the official results actually showed JFK with 34 million popular votes to Nixon's 34,100,000. It's about 100,000 that separated them. Isn't it amazing how tight these elections are? That's a good thing, isn't it? When you have competitive elections, that means that people are competing for every single last vote. That means that their governance, the decisions that they make, are actually more representative. We've had 58 total elections. I correct myself. 58 total elections since the since our amazing American founding. Thank you, Mr. Producer. See, we get live fact checks here, and we're always very precise. And so the other question, so it's really important to remember that when you actually vote for a presidential candidate, when you cast your vote for a presidential candidate, you're not actually voting for the person. You're voting for an elector. You're voting for someone to actually vote for you. And this is really interesting. So you're actually not voting for Donald Trump. You might be voting for Donald Smith. And so not every state binds their electors. So the District of Columbia and 26 other states, they bind their electors to vote for their promised candidate. But sometimes you get what's called a faithless elector. It's actually happened in 2016. This has happened in 1948, 1956, 1960, 68, 72, 76, 88. A blank ballot was cast in 2000. And in 2016, I think it was the most ever, seven electors broke with their state on the presidential ballot and six did so on the vice presidential ballot. That's also a nice, interesting cocktail party trivia question, isn't it? Do you know that they actually cast separate votes for president and then for vice president? Really interesting. And so you're actually not voting for the person, you're voting for the electors to vote for the person. And each state can determine how to do that, but that's the way that the Electoral College is designed. And so the first thing we talk about is diversity. Let's go back to these numbers that I talked about. Counties won by Donald Trump, 2,626, Hillary, 487. Who has a more diverse representation of states? States won. Donald Trump, 30, Hillary, 20. And what the Electoral College does is it demands the time, energy, focus, and money of a candidate to a wide variety of states. And this is really important because a state can actually design itself into the national conversation. A state can actually program itself to say, hey, come pay attention to us. How is that possible? Let's use the example of Maine and Nebraska. Maine and Nebraska actually allocate their electors based on congressional districts. So every state has the freedom to do this. So the state, this is so important because the states created the federal government. The federal government did not create the states. We are a federalist country, first and foremost. The states voluntarily came together and created a federal system. This is really important. The federal government did not exist first and then divide up things as the states. So we believe firmly in states' rights. So Nebraska, for example, allocates their electoral votes based on how a congressional district votes for the president. And so one of the most interesting ones to look at was back in 2008. Here's another good cocktail party trivia question. Did you know that Barack Obama won one electoral vote, won a singular electoral vote in Nebraska in 2008? He visited there right near the Iowa caucus, in January, February 2008, and stirred up a lot of support. He made an extra stop to Omaha, Nebraska, and he made a couple other campaign stops, and so did then Senator Biden, and ended up winning an electoral vote in all places of Nebraska. That's right. President Barack Obama won an electoral vote in Nebraska. Now, he lost back that electoral vote to Mitt Romney in 2012, but it goes to show that Nebraska wanted more attention. A state like Nebraska, you wouldn't think would actually get attention or visits from a presidential candidate. But they said, you know what? We have a singular population center. We have more than one congressman. Let's make it so that we can demand the time and energy of candidates in both parties. And that's exactly what happened. Barack Obama won that singular electoral vote. The second example would be Maine. Maine also allocates their electoral votes based on congressional district. And Donald Trump made several visits back in the 2016 election to central Maine, a place that feels a lot like Ohio, that has, unfortunately, an opioid epidemic, that has a depleted manufacturing base, and has middle-class workers that have really felt out of touch with the Malibu and Manhattan elites. So Donald Trump made many visits up to Maine, and so did Eric Trump. I actually remember being on conference calls with Eric Trump and Don Jr., and Eric's like, I'm going up there. We're going to win this congressional seat, and with it, we're going to win an electoral vote, and they did. and Donald Trump, part of his victory, part of the end result of Donald Trump getting 304 electoral votes, was actually getting that main seat. And if you actually look at it, if Donald Trump wouldn't have won Pennsylvania, wouldn't have won Michigan, actually would have been really, really consequential and potentially a tie-breaking electoral vote. And so the states can design themselves into the system. And this is really important because, as Louis Brandeis says, the great Justice Brandeis, states should be laboratories of democracy. States should be a place where ideas can be tested and tried. It's exactly what the Electoral College allows. You erode that, all of a sudden you think a candidate is going to visit Omaha, Nebraska, or Maine once the national popular vote is instituted? The diversity of states, the diversity of backgrounds, whether it be talking to the Cuban population in southern Florida, or talking to farmers in Iowa, or talking to recent Asian American immigrants in Reno, Nevada, all of those parts of the country, they demand the time and energy, focus, and money of the candidates that otherwise wouldn't. So that's diversity, and it's so important because if you just have a national popular vote, the candidates will go naturally to where the popular vote is. They'll run up the score in places like New York, Philadelphia, Miami, Houston, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland. What do all those cities have in common? Well, they have urban-focused issues. And they also think basically the same on all the major issues, and also opens itself up to fraud. That's the second issue, is integrity. The Electoral College, because of its decentralized nature, has the greatest hedge and the greatest protection away from voter fraud. Voter fraud is something that I think is one of the great issues that is not talked about enough during our time, during our period of time in American politics right now. But if you think the fraud is bad right now in California with ballot harvesting, if you think the fraud is bad right now in Chicago, and I can attest to the voter fraud in Chicago being from the suburbs of Chicago, just wait until these states matter even more. All of a sudden, candidates will focus all their time on coastal elite issues. It will further radicalize and divide our country. So not only will you have many, many people running for office, you'll now have regional parties pop up. Not a national. See, the idea of the national popular vote will actually do the exact opposite. A national popular vote will make us less unified, because all of a sudden, then you'll have a candidate that will run basically just on the Midwest. You'll have a Midwest candidate. You'll have a Northeast candidate. And if you want to talk about something that will hyper-divide America even further than it already is right now, put in a national popular vote that will say all you need is a plurality to win. Well, boy, if all you need is a plurality to win, then you're going to see a Midwest candidate, a Midwest party come up on issues that don't resonate at all with the Northeast, and the idea of building a broad-based coalition will completely and totally deteriorate. Second reason is integrity. Is yes, there is voter fraud, but because of the Electoral College, it does not allow the urban cities to run up the score and have these very hyper-liberal, hyper-leftist areas be able to utilize the dominance of the electoral system within the cities. And the third thing is accountability. You know that old saying, all politics is local, or all politics is local? Well, this is exactly what the Electoral College focuses on, is that not only do states matter, but specific counties matter. Is that presidential candidates go visit swing counties after swing counties, and they have to focus on issues that will matter at the most molecular level possible, whether it be Macomb County in Michigan that Donald Trump won, first Republican to win Macomb County in a long time, or Trumbull County in Ohio, first Republican to win that county in a long, long time. And Maine and Nebraska, let's go back to Maine and Nebraska, they both use an alternative method of distributing their electoral votes called the congressional district method. I want to be very clear on this. The winner of each district is awarded one electoral vote, and the winner of the statewide vote is then awarded the state's remaining two electoral votes. I want to just clarify what I said earlier and just kind of reinforce it that, yes, it is based on certain congressional districts. And by the way, more states can do this if they want. What if California did this? Now, California won't do this, even though California would be better represented. California actually, here's another fun fact for you. You know, California has more registered Republicans than any other state in the country. Wouldn't California, if California really wants to be cutting edge, if California really wants to be progressive, don't you think they should have the opportunity to represent the many millions of registered Republicans in their states, not just all the Democrats that happen to win their elections? Of course, they won't do that because California Democrats want to continue their control. And so goes that third reason why I love the Electoral College is accountability. It keeps presidential candidates accountable. It makes them go to hyper-specific counties and prove the results that they have delivered. It makes President Trump, he's able to go back to Macomb County and say, I have brought manufacturing jobs back to this country. Makes him go back to West Virginia. I've brought manufacturing jobs back to this county. What actually happens? People ask this. Charlie, what happens if the Electoral College, no candidate actually receives a majority? This is really important. So it does not require, you actually have to have a majority of electoral votes. You don't have to have a plurality of electoral votes. So that's really interesting. You think about it. You need a majority of electoral votes, but let's pretend that doesn't happen. Well, then a contingent election is held. The election of the president goes to the House of Representatives. This is really interesting. And each state delegation, so each state gets one vote, again, back to states' rights, they get one vote and then one vote for one of the top three contenders to determine a winner. This has only happened twice in year 1800 and 1824. This could theoretically happen again in 2016. Again, people bring up the 1876 election a lot. It was not officially a contingent election in 1876. South Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, they submitted certificates of elections for both candidates. A bipartisan commission of representatives, senators, and Supreme Court justices reviewed the ballots and awarded all three states' electoral votes to Rutherford B. Hayes of Ohio, who won the presidency by a single electoral vote. People like to bring up the election of 1876 a lot. Now, that could happen today. Let's say that Donald Trump only wins 269 electoral votes and the Democrat wins 268, and that's just the way to, oh my goodness, what would happen? It would go to the House of Representatives and each state would get one vote. There's mechanisms and ways to account for all the different possible checks and balances, all the different problems that could arise. Again, that goes back to that idea of accountability. So then you have to ask yourself the question, has this system worked? And the answer is absolutely yes. With the flaws that people might say is, well, I live in Illinois and my vote doesn't matter. Well, that's just not true at all. Your vote does matter. You don't know how each state is going to vote each time, because I heard people in Michigan saying that their vote didn't matter and Donald Trump won Michigan in surprising fashion. I heard people in Wisconsin say my vote doesn't matter and Donald Trump won Wisconsin in a surprising manner. Every state matters. Any state can vote any way at any time. Don't fall into the trap that every state is always going to vote a certain way. Of course, there's a higher likelihood that California is going to vote for a Democrat in 2020. But don't believe that, oh, my vote's going to matter more or matter less. But I will say this. If you're in a state such as Nevada and you have specific needs and wants that Nevada has or Iowa, why on earth would you give up your sovereignty? Why on earth would you give up your ability to have a voice in the process to people that want nothing to do with you from Manhattan and Malibu? And the Electoral College maximizes the voice and the representation that the Founding Fathers saw as a potential issue. The Founding Fathers did not want the tyranny of the majority. The Founding Fathers did not want the most amount of people to vote the most amount of stuff for themselves from the urban centers. They saw this collision course happening. And that is why the Electoral College is critical to the Republic. And we're not a democracy. Bernie Sanders says we're a democracy. We're not a democracy. We are a republic. A democracy would mean if 51% of people think something, all of a sudden it then becomes true. A republic has certain irrefutable, transcendent truths that are then enumerated and protected by the government. That even if 55%, 60% of people think that free speech should go away, it still is protected within the United States Constitution. And so I hope that crash course on the Electoral College was helpful. We have to do everything we possibly can to prevent this national popular vote movement from gaining traction, because they have figured out a way to reverse engineer the states to try to deteriorate and destroy the Electoral College as we see fit. And I believe one of the great reasons we have had a peaceful transfer of power, despite many divided moments in our history, despite many times that we literally went to a civil war, is thanks to the Electoral College. It would be a major mistake to destroy it, because then we would have the tyranny of the majority, we'd have a quasi-parliamentary system, we'd have factions, we'd have fractionalization, we'd have rampant voter fraud, you would have presidential candidates that would never visit Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. They would never visit those states again. Instead, they would visit the coastal urban centers with one-size-fits-all type policies. And remember, 43 of 50 states, that's right, 43 of 50 states have smaller populations than the city of Los Angeles. Don't let LA and New York determine the future of our country. All right, well, that was a great segment on the Electoral College. We're going to keep diving into that, obviously, heading into the 2020 election. I think that's going to be a top focus of the left to try to destroy and abolish the Electoral College. Coming up this weekend, we have our Young Women's Leadership Summit, TPUSA.com, Turning Point USA, please support us if you're interested or able. We are fighting America's culture war on the front lines. I'm going to be interviewing Nikki Haley, and we are going to put that exclusively on our podcast next week. And we might have another episode coming live from the Young Women's Leadership Summit later this week. If you're listening, please give us those 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Press subscribe. It really helps us out. Give us your feedback. Ask us those questions. We're going to take audience questions in our episode later this week. And thank you so much for supporting our show. Go to tpusa.com to learn more. We'll be back soon on the Charlie Kirk Show, fighting for freedom every single time.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.